Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast and check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, make sure you check out all the other things that 1517 is doing, which is a lot of things. I mean, we're writing a lot of books, writing a lot of articles, doing a lot of online academies that you can take for free. Go check out videos from past conferences that we've done, all kinds of things. You can check out all that stuff at 1517.org. Chad, last week we got all into Josiah's reforms and wrapped those up. We got to hear about a Passover to dwarf all Passovers that Josiah puts in place. We hear that Josiah is the model king. There's never been anyone like him before that. There certainly was no one like him after that. And sort of we were talking afterwards that Josiah, despite just being, I mean, you can't think of a way that he could have been better. There's not like this, well, there's this one thing. There's no things with Josiah that could have been better. All of this is not enough to make God say, you know what, my wrath isn't coming. And we kind of talked about Josiah being sort of the one of those guys, maybe the only guy ever, that was sort of holding back the tsunami of God's wrath. As long as Josiah was there, God's wrath was not going to come. But Josiah doesn't live to be an old man, and God is not going to have Josiah live forever. In this way, he's sort of Christ-like in this mediation role, right? He is this person that is standing between you and the wrath of God. And once he's gone, it happens quick.
Yeah, really quick. So Josiah's reign ends about 609 BC, all right? So 609, and then 586 BC is the end, like the funeral for the southern kingdom. So it's not going to be long from here on out. As I mentioned, I think once or twice already, you're going to have basically four more kings. And three of these kings are going to be sons of Josiah, and one of them is going to be his grandson. And then that's it. So we really plummet here. We go from the best king ever, all of a sudden, 20 years later, to where this best king's kingdom is destroyed. We're going to see the temple taken apart piece by piece and shipped off to Babylon. We're going to see the people not in one, but in two or three deportations, all exiled to Babylon. We're going to see a bunch of people put to death. We're going to see the last king has his sons slaughtered before him, and then he himself is blinded and then shipped off to captivity. So a lot of bad things that are coming up. So, we wrapped up with verse 30 of 2 Kings 23 last time. So verse 31 is going to introduce us to Josiah's replacement. But he's not going to last very long. His name is Jehoahaz. He's pretty young. He's 23 years old when he starts to reign after his dad is killed in that encounter with Pharaoh. And he lasts 3 months. So relatively short reign, I think we could all agree. He's 23, and he only lasts 3 months. And here's the reason why. Verse 32 says, it doesn't really give us any more explanation, but it says he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his fathers had done.
Yeah, notice that's fathers and not father, right? If only he had done what his father had done, but instead he did what his fathers had done, and that's not nearly as good. This also tells me that Josiah had this guy young.
Yeah.
This guy's 23 years old. Josiah was not that old when he died. I mean, Josiah was having heirs young.
yeah, very young. He takes over, and it didn't last long because the same Pharaoh that killed this guy's dad, that killed Josiah, puts him in bonds. And we're not really told why, but he put him in bonds in a place called Riblah, which is up in the area of Syria, that he might not reign in Jerusalem. So whatever it was about this guy, Jehoahaz, the Pharaoh didn't like him. And at this point, Pharaoh is in control of this area. It's going to be short-lived control because the Babylonians are soon going to sweep in and take over control. But for now, anyway, Egypt has control of this area. So Pharaoh just says, you know what? I killed your dad. I don't really like you, Jehoahaz. So I'm going to replace you. So he puts him in prison, and then he ships him off, and he lays He lays a tribute on the land of 100 talents of silver and a talent of gold. So not only is he going to remove the replacement king because he doesn't like him, he's going to take him down to Egypt. And he's going to replace him with somebody else, and he's going to make sure that he gets rich off the deal, all this silver and all this gold. So verse 34 says that Pharaoh Necho made Eliakim, the son of Josiah, king in place of Josiah's father. And then he changed his name, and it'll like change his name to a pagan name or something like that. This was a name change simply to show, hey, I'm the guy in charge. So if I want to change your name from Eliakim to Jehoiakim, I can. I'm going to give you a new, the taking of a new name by a king is not unusual. You have that happening all over the place.
Hey, the Pope still does that.
I was going to say, yeah, it's funny. You thought, because in my mind, I was thinking that too. The Pope, when the Pope becomes the head of the Roman Catholic Church, well, does that too, right? So same thing happens here. So you have Eliakim's name changed by the Pharaoh, though, to Jehoiakim. So Jehoahaz is out. He's the first son of Josiah that gets replaced last 3 months. He's replaced by Eliakim, now known as Jehoiakim. And then took Jehoahaz away. He came to Egypt, and that's where he died. Which is, in the big scheme of biblical history, it's like, oh, wow, it's kind of weird, huh? That a king of Israel, the Israel that was taken out of Egypt and taken to the promised land and settled in the promised land. Well, now that king is overtaken by the Egyptians, shipped back to Egypt, and dies there. So we've come a long way from the Exodus. We've even come a long way from Solomon. Solomon is marrying the daughter of Pharaoh.
Yeah.
And here we have Pharaoh taking the king of Israel in chains, shipping him back to Egypt, and that's where he dies. Now, Jehoiakim, his replacement, his brother, half-brother, and the second son of Josiah to reign, he gave the Pharaoh what he wanted. He gave him silver, he gave him gold, and he got that by levying heavy taxes against the people. He taxed the land to give the money according to the command of Pharaoh. He exacted the silver and the gold of the people of the land from everyone according to his assessment to give to Pharaoh. So Pharaoh's getting what he wants. He's in control. He puts this young guy on the throne, changes his name, and is taking in this money from the Israelites, this silver and this gold. We're told that Jehoiakim was 25 when he starts to reign, and he made it 11 years in Jerusalem. So he certainly made it a lot longer than his brother did. His brother lasted 3 months. He makes it 11 years. And the chapter ends up simply by telling us what his mom's name was, Zebediah. And just like his brother, we're told that he too, verse 37, did what was evil in the sight of the Lord according to all that his fathers had done. So you can see the downward spiral here. I mean, you go from Josiah, who loves the Lord as God with all his heart and soul and might, and then one king, one son after the next son, we're told, did the exact opposite. They did what was evil in God's sight, just like all the most of the pre-Josiah kings had done. So this is chapter 24. It kind of starts midway. It's probably not a very good chapter division here, but anyway, this is the beginning of chapter 24. So we got chapter 24, and then we got chapter 25, and that's going to be it for Kings. So in his days, that is in the days of the second of Josiah's sons, Jehoiakim, Nebuchadnezzar. Now we've heard a lot about. I heard all about Nebuchadnezzar when I was growing up in Sunday school.
Yeah, this is some Daniel stuff, and people are like, oh, we're moving into straight from Second Kings to Daniel. Is that what we're doing next? I mean, you could.
Yeah, you certainly could. Yeah, in fact, in just a minute, we're going to hear about a deportation in which Ezekiel was one of the people who was deported. So, if you're familiar with other parts of the Old Testament, like the Book of Daniel, or like the book of Ezekiel, then you're going to start hearing about things happening, and probably already some of the names of these kings meet me like, oh, yeah, yeah, Jeremiah talks about him, and Daniel mentions him, and Ezekiel mentions him. All these guys, we have a lot of biblical literature, prophetic biblical literature, that is involved with this particular time period, because it was, you know, it was a lot of upheaval. So God was sending him Jeremiah, he was sending him Ezekiel, and he was sending him Daniel. A lot of stuff was happening during this period of Israel's history. So Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, he came up, and Jehoiakim became his servant for 3 years. So even though the Bible really doesn't say very much about this, there's obviously a power shift, right? We heard about the Assyrians and everything that they did, how long they were under in control. Well, when the Babylonians and the Medes captured Nineveh and destroyed the Assyrian Empire, then we pass from the Assyrians being the top dog to the Babylonians being the top dog. And even though the Egyptians had been in control for a time, now they're driven backward. The heyday of the Egyptian power has long since passed. I mean, they were the power for a long time, but their days are past being numbered. They are going to diminish in power significantly over the next few centuries. Babylon is going to be the king, at least for a while, until the Persians show up. So Nebuchadnezzar is the most famous of these Babylonian kings. He comes up, and when he takes over, then Jehoiakim is going to be his servant. He does this for 3 years. And then the end of verse 1 tells us that he decided that he was going to rebel against the Babylonians. Probably the reason was, at one point, the Babylonians attempted to invade Egypt, and they were thwarted in their attempt. So probably what happened was Jehoiakim saw that the Babylonians were unsuccessful in this battle against the Egyptians, and he thought, oh, here's my chance. I'm going to rebel. Maybe they're not as strong as they think they are. So he rebels. Well, that didn't work out very well for him.
Here's what's crazy about this is that, so he decides he's going to rebel, and what you really want, if you're going to rebel against Babylon, who's like superpowered, this isn't the first time you've seen little old Judah or Israel or the people, little old people of God decide they're going to go up against like a mighty foe. Like this happens. We've seen this over and over again. And guess what? If you got the Lord on your side, ain't no big deal. Well, you got this. You got the opposite of that going on right here. Like, so this guy rebels against Babylon, and whose side is God on? Babylon's side,
yeah. Yeah, God actually sent Babylon to do this. They are the sword in the Lord's hand to punish the Israelites. So this is going to end badly. Verse 2 tells us that in response to this, the Lord sent against him, that is against the king, Jehoiakim, bands of the Chaldeans and bands of the Syrians and bands of the Moabites and bands of the Ammonites, and sent them against Judah to destroy it, according to the word of the Lord that he spoke by his servants, the prophets. So God is making use of probably these nations that had been overtaken and now were allied to the Babylonians to punish the king. So you want rebellion? Well, I'll give you rebellion. I'm going to have all these other people come and attack you. So that was verse 2. Verse 3 begins a bit of a theological explanation for why this went down the way that it did. Surely this came upon Judah at the command of the Lord to remove them out of his sight. Why? For the sins of Manasseh, according to all that he had done, and also for the innocent blood that he had shed. For he filled Jerusalem with innocent blood, and the Lord would not pardon. So we're back to Manasseh. So, you know, so if you think of Jeroboam as the capital T center of the northern kingdom, then you can kind of think of Manasseh as the capital T center of the southern kingdom. Yeah. So just like Jeroboam made Israel to sin, Manasseh made Judah to sin.
Well, it's like the reason Jeroboam introduces so much stuff, and creates like the space for like all of this idolatry to just get run rampant, which ends up resulting in like the extreme version of it, which is like human sacrifice and that kind of stuff. But Jeroboam's like the domino. That's why he gets that all the time, right? He's the first domino.
Yeah, and then the other one just perpetuated or expanded after him. Yeah, yeah. And then Well, Manasseh's done. It's kind of on the opposite in the sense of Manasseh's not the first. He's not like the first king of the north of the southern kingdom that starts all this. But he is kind of the acme. You know, we have a lot of idolatry, and then you have a little reprieve in people, you know, like Hezekiah. But then along comes Manasseh, and he's the idol collector. He's like, oh, I like that. You know, he's logging on to Amazon every day and just like shopping for idols and having them sent to the doorstep of Jerusalem and erecting them all over the place. So that he becomes the southern kingdom's Jeroboam figure. And then not only that, but he also filled Jerusalem with innocent blood.
Yeah.
And some of that innocent blood probably flowed through the veins of Isaiah, who was, according to tradition, was martyred during his wicked reign. Verse 5 tells us, if we want to find out more about Jehoiakim, well, just check out the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah. Jehoiakim slept with his fathers, and Jehoiachin, his son, reigned in his place. Verse 7, and the king of Egypt did not come against, and the king of Egypt did not come again out of his land, for the king of Babylon had taken all that belonged to the king of Egypt. So the Egyptians are no longer a threat to this area because the Babylonians have taken over. And they took over, so here's your geographical markers, from the brook of Egypt to the river Euphrates. Now, the reason that's important is because that is almost verbatim how the Solomonic Empire was described. So if you go back to 1 Kings chapter 4 and you hear about how far Solomon's kingdom extended, it's basically from the brook of Egypt to the river Euphrates. So now you certainly don't have the Solomonic Empire anymore, but you do have the Babylonian Empire, which encompasses everything that Solomon had, plus a whole lot of other areas as well. So we've taken care of the first two of these kings. You had Jehoahaz, who only lasted 3 months, son of Josiah. Then you have his half-brother, Jehoiakim. He makes it 11 years. Now we're going to hear about his son, so Jehoiachin, and we'll find out how well his reign was. So Jehoiachin was 18 when he became king, and he reigned 3 months. I'm discerning a pattern here, Dan. Yeah, 3 months. 3 months in Jerusalem. His mom's name was Nehushta, and he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord according to all that his father had done. Interesting. Singular there. Yeah. The other ones had plural. Yeah. Now it is correct to say that Jehoiachin did all the evil according to what his father has done, because his father was not Josiah, but Jehoiakim. So now this is the grandson, in other words, of Josiah. Makes it for 3 months. So what happened to him? Well, at that time, the servants of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up to Jerusalem, and they had to besiege the city. Well, what that tells you is that they didn't open the gates to Nebuchadnezzar. I mean, of course, you don't besiege a city that is surrendering to you. So rather than surrendering to the Babylonians, they decide, you know what? We're going to try and hold out and see how long we can make it. And Jerusalem, I mean, was set up to be a good city to survive a siege. You had the famous water tunnel that Hezekiah had dug, so they had a ready access to water, and it was on a hill. I mean, where you have pretty good natural protection on all sides. So I mean, if you're going to have to endure a siege, Jerusalem is a pretty good city to have to endure a siege in. But things aren't still going to go well for him, because Nebuchadnezzar, Babylon, king of Babylon, came to the city while his servants were besieging it. And then Jehoiachin decides he's just going to give up. He gave himself up to the king of Babylon, himself, his mom, his servants, his officials, his palace officials. So the king of Babylon took him prisoner in the 8th year of his reign. Now, this isn't the end. No, we're not talking about 586 BC. We're not talking about the temple's destruction. We're not talking about Jerusalem's destruction. We're talking about something that happens prior to that. So sometimes I think we kind of have in our heads, yeah, that you had the Babylonian exile, and that was really the only time you had this massive deportation. No, you had several different deportations of people that took place. And Ezekiel is going to be swept up in this one. So this is the eighth year of the reign of this king. And so he's going to be hauled off along with these other officials, as well as all the treasures of the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king's house. He takes all the vessels of gold in the temple that Solomon had made, and he kind of chops those up. And he carried away, we read verse 14, all Jerusalem, the officials, the mighty men of valor, 10,000 captives, the craftsmen, the smiths. None remained except the poorest people of the land. And verse 15 says that he carried away the king, Jehoiachin, to Babylon. The king's mother, wives, officials, all these people are listed there in verses 15, 16, and 17. So this is a huge deportation of people from Jerusalem. You got all the leadership, you got the king, you got the king's family, you have them taking the gold from the temple in Jerusalem and then chopping that up and taking that off as well. It sounds like the end, but it's not quite the end yet. Because if Jerusalem had not rebelled after this, then the city would remain standing. But as we'll see, things did not go that way. So who's going to be his replacement? Well, the king of Babylon, verse 17, took Mattaniah, who was Jehoiachin's uncle, and made him king in his place. And what's more, we have a name change. He changed his name to Zedekiah. So this is the third son of Josiah to reign after him, and the youngest of these sons also to reign after him. I always remember his name because, of course, Z is the last letter of the English alphabet, and this is the last king of Judah, Southern Kingdom.
This guy is young too. I mean, so this guy is 21 years old, and there's a pattern here of these kings being really young. Now, Josiah obviously is 8 years old, but it seems that maybe the king of Babylon is like young people are easier to control. Manipulate, they're foolish, dumb, they don't know anything, and just keep lining up. Of course, I mean, if you're having kings not reigning very long, the next guy up is going to be young, but he could put anyone he wants as king, and he keeps choosing.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
you know, young and young guys,
yeah, and yeah, he probably thinks they're going to be easy to control, and you know, some are, some are not. This guy, Zedekiah, who's 21, well, he makes it 11 years. So like 3 months and 11 years seems to be the pattern here.
Yeah.
Either make it 3 months. If you make it to 4 months, you're going to make it to 11 years. We hear about his mom, who's the daughter of some guy named Jeremiah. This is not our Jeremiah, the prophet, but some guy named Jeremiah. And verse 19, same thing. He did what was evil in the Lord's sight, just like Jehoiakim had done. And because of the anger of the Lord, it came to the point in Jerusalem and Judah that God is going to cast them out from his presence. And the way this is all precipitated is by Zedekiah, and this is the way chapter 24 ends, Zedekiah rebelling against the king of Babylon. Not a good idea.
Yeah.
And, exactly what Jeremiah, if you read Jeremiah, exactly what Jeremiah would tell them over and over and over not to do.
Yeah.
He would tell them, listen, you don't like the Babylonians any more than I like the Babylonians, but they are God's agent that he has sent. So if you rebel against them, you're rebelling against God, more or less.
Yeah, this I mean, he rebels against Babylon, and he rebels against Babylon on his own. It's
yes,
not something without, you're doing without, with God.
Yeah, there was no divine imprimatur. God did not send a prophet to say, hey, Zedekiah, why don't you rebel against the king of Babylon? Some false prophets would have said that, but not God's true prophet. So, chapter 25, the closing chapter. In the ninth year of his reign, in the 10th month, on the 10th day of the month, Nebuchadnezzar is probably by this point tired of Jerusalem. You can imagine, the king is like, receives word, he's like, what?
Yeah, they rebelled. These people are wearing him out.
Yeah, same thing happened. I mean, this we're going to have history repeat itself with the Romans in the first century. They're going to get to the point to where you have Jewish rebellion after Jewish rebellion after Jewish rebellion until finally the Romans are like, enough is enough. And they're going to stamp out that rebellion. And of course, that leads to the temple's destruction in 70 AD, paralleling the destruction that's about to take place here. So Nebuchadnezzar comes up, and they besiege Jerusalem, build siege works against it, and it's under siege for a long time. I mean, the conditions within the city were probably beyond horrendous. Besieged until the 11th year of King Zedekiah. So if you read sometime the Book of Lamentations, which you preached the Lamentations, didn't you, one time?
I did.
Yeah. Read Lamentations and read some of the descriptions about the horrors that are described in that lament. That was what this was describing.
You're talking about getting all the way down to cannibalism, and it's brutal.
Yeah, I mean, you're trapped. I mean, you've got no way. So I don't care how many food stores you have. I don't care. The water's not gonna be an issue. The food is the issue. You got plenty of water, but you can't eat water. You get to the point to where you've eaten all of your grain stores. You've eaten, you know, every animal in sight. And you know, we talked about how they were eating donkey's brains and pigeon poop. In the end, you resort to cannibalism, which is what Lamentations describes. So on the ninth day of the fourth month, the famine was so severe in the city that there was no food for the people of the land. Things got down to the very, very bottom. Then there's a breach made in the city wall, and the men of war decide they're just going to get out while the getting's good. They flee by night by way of the gate between the two walls by the king's garden. And the Chaldeans were all around the city. So this is a chance for the king and some of the warriors to try and escape. Interestingly, they go out by the king's garden. I can't help but kind of hear an echo there of early chapters of Genesis here. You know, you're fleeing by way of the garden, and things are not going to go well for you. They go in the direction of the Arabah, which is south of the desert region, but they pursue them and they overtake them, ironically, in the plains of Jericho. So Jericho was the first city that the Israelites captured way back in the book of Joshua. And here it's going to be the place where the very last king of Israel is going to be faced with defeat. All his army scatters. They capture the king, and they bring him to the king of Babylon. And he passed sentence on him. And I can't really imagine a worse sentence.
This is as bad as it gets.
Yeah, I mean, so what was the sentence? Well, they take the sons of Zedekiah, who had to have been little boys.
Yeah, he's not very old.
Yeah, this guy's not very old. At this point, he is probably about 32. So his sons, you know, obviously are very young, and they slaughter the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes, and then they turn around and they put out the eyes of Zedekiah, bind him in chains, and then take him off to Babylon.
Yeah.
So that obviously the very last thing that he sees is the very last thing that any father would ever want to see. So that becomes the image that is emblazoned in his mind for forever thereafter.
Yeah, it is a creative and sadistic punishment.
Yeah, that's a perfect way to describe it. And that's the last king. That's the last king of the Davidic line. Now we're not quite done. We're beginning this last chapter. But Zedekiah and what happens to him, blinded, his sons killed. Which is, of course, also not without significance, because these are, again, in the Davidic line. They're all slaughtered. They're put to death. And he himself is taken in chains then to Babylon. So what happens after this? Well, in the fifth month, the seventh day of the month, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, along with the captain of his bodyguard, a guy by the name of Nebuzaradan, they came to Jerusalem, and they just start tearing stuff up. Verse 9 says that the first thing that they did was they torched the temple. They burned the house of the Lord, and then they turned to the king's house and all the houses of Jerusalem, all the big houses, they torched. I mean, the place was just on fire. And then they broke down the walls around Jerusalem. And then everybody who was left in the city, all of the people that had deserted to them, everybody who was still kind of there, they hauled off in exile. The only people that they left behind, verse 12 tells us, were the poorest of the land, so they could be vine dressers and plowmen. So they're leaving behind a few people to just kind of take care of the area. But Jerusalem itself, the city, the temple, the palace, all the big houses, everything is destroyed by the Babylonian bulldozer. They're just taking everything. They're wanting to make sure that no one misses the message. Mess with Babylon, rebel against us, test our patience, and this is what will happen. This is what will happen to you.
Yeah, the idea here is to put an end to your kingly line, put an end to your religion. There is nothing for you. There's nothing to rise up. We've destroyed your temple. We've ended your dynasty. All we've left behind is people who are of no threat to raise an army. And there's nothing. We've torn down the wall. There's nothing to go back to.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's nothing to go back to because you have no defense. You have no houses. You have no temple. Everything has been destroyed. Now, verse 13 through 17 just basically takes us bit by bit through what they did to the temple itself. It talks about how the pillars of bronze that were in there and the bronze sea, they broke all that up into pieces and they hauled that off to Babylon. We have reference to various utensils that were used there in the temple. The two pillars, you know, the ones that stood in the front, talks about how they how big they were and how they were destroyed. And it just, these verses just kind of go, they want to make sure that you don't miss that all the things that were at the temple were no longer at the temple. They were taken in pieces. And there's kind of a symbolism here because these things which were, you know, so central to Israel and at the house of God, all of that is not only destroyed, but broken into pieces and shipped off.
Yeah.
So destroyed, decimated, and then also deported so that it's no longer even there anymore. So that it becomes basically cash in the pocket of the Babylonian king.
I know we've made this point before. We've done this when we were, you know, establishing Israel and they were going into places and they were wiping things out. And you're like, man, this seems like a lot. You have to remember that what's happening here is the wrath of God. And God is long provoked. In other words, he's very patient. That God does not, he's long in nose, as we've talked about before. But much like when the people of God go into Canaan, this is not dissimilar from this in the sense that when the wrath of God comes, it is thorough. It is not just like a little bit of wrath, you know, a little taste of wrath. When the wrath of God comes, it takes out everything. This is significant because for us, as we know, like where ultimately the wrath of God rests, which is at the cross of Christ, that it's all there. It's not like he's saving some for you. Christ has taken all of it. And in this situation, they're supposed to tell you something about the wrath of God. Look at how thorough this is. The temple's gone, the stuff's gone, the houses are gone, the people are gone. Everything is destroyed because that's when the bill comes due for sin, that's always how it is.
100%. Yeah, so what is happening here to the temple and everything connected with it and the people? Well, that's what the Israelites were to do to the Canaanites, right? They were to tear down all their religious stuff and to take out all the people. Well, now that things have come full circle and Israel has become completely Canaanized, well, now God is using the Babylonians to do to them what originally the Israelites did to the Canaanites. God doesn't deal with sin in halves or percentages, but always in totality.
That's why you really want Christ to deal with it, because it's not something you want to deal with on your own.
Yeah, yeah. So I was just this kind of an aside has made me think of it. I was reading Matt Popovitz's new book. It's not out yet, but this was a pre-release, and in the front of it, I wish I could quote Jared Wilson verbatim, but he wrote the preface for it, and he talked about how some of his kids had come home from school and told him that one of their teachers had said that Jesus died for the sins of the world, but for the really bad sins, there still might be some punishment in the afterlife. Maybe think of this. You're like, well, no. Thanks be to God, because all the wrath was done for.
Yeah.
It's not like if you're in Christ Jesus, then, you know, 99% of your condemnation is taken care of. No, it's done in totality. 100% is taken care of by Christ.
Yeah, and this is, we talked about this kind of last episode, that Josiah is the best. Jesus hadn't said that John the Baptist was the greatest man that ever lived. You might think it was Josiah. He's not enough to stop this. You're going to need somebody else. And that's what this is all showing you.
Yeah. Kings is leading us to really to Bethlehem. It's leading us to the Son of David who is to come. And kind of summarize some of this is coming up. So 18 through 21, this basically tells us that the Babylonians gathered up much of the leadership from the city of Jerusalem, and they put them to death. So, I mean, it wasn't like everybody got to live who was, you know, like just taken off in exile. They did gather up some of the chief priests and the keepers of the threshold and some of the other people that were part of the military, and they took them to Nebuzaradan, who was the Babylonian captain of the guard, and they put him to death. So there were executions that took place as well. And then we have this. This is the very end of verse 21. That kind of, in just, you know, a few words, sums up everything that's been leading to this point. So Judah was taken into exile out of its land. Kind of a very brief, seemingly anticlimactic summary, but that's what this has all been leading us to. Judah was taken into exile out of its land. So what happens afterward? What happens when all these people are either executed or shipped off to Babylon? Well, it wasn't like, you know, there wasn't any concern anymore of the Babylonians for this area. You know, they want to make sure that, you know, things are at least go as smoothly as possible. So Nebuchadnezzar appoints a guy by the name of Gedaliah, who's going to be the governor of this place. So he's in charge. I mean, the Babylonians are in charge, but he's underneath them. He's supposed to kind of, you know, make sure everything is done accordingly. But this doesn't last very long either, because so Gedaliah is in charge, and then some other Israelites come to meet with him, and he tries to reason with them. Verse 24 says, he says, listen, guys, don't be afraid of the Chaldean officials. All we need to do is to live in this land. We serve the king of Babylon, and everything's going to be great. Everything will be well, which, of course, makes sense. We saw what happened when we rebelled. Things did not go well. They destroyed everything. Now, we have at least maybe a little bit of a peace now. We've got some land here, and even though most of our people are in Babylon, they've let us live here, Gedaliah says. So why don't we just kind of be cool and live at peace with the Babylonians? And they don't listen to him, because it doesn't take long before they sneak up on him and ambush Gedaliah, and they put him to death. And not only that, so they executed the very one that the Babylonians put in charge. But these guys are so scared of the Babylonian forces that they hightail it to Egypt to try and get away. So even they took out Gedaliah, but did him no good, because they themselves were afraid of the Babylonian revenge against what they'd done. So they have to take off to Egypt. So they go into exile themselves in Egypt, just like their brothers and sisters had gone into exile in Babylon.
Yeah, this is some kind of weird last gasp thing. Like, there's a guy, this is this strange thing where there's like this small group of people that could have some semblance of peace and like maybe a life that wasn't, because the Babylonians don't really care what you're doing as long as you're not doing that. You know, so mm-hmm. Like, as long as you're not.
Yeah, as long as you're making their life easy, they don't really care.
Yeah, but. This is kind of how this sort of is the sort of the wrath of God is going to affect everyone, and then you end up just completing the whole thing. Like, we're going to strike this guy down, and now we're going to end up in captivity. Like, I don't know what you're trying to accomplish here, but like now the exile has been finalized.
Yeah, and that's kind of where everything is left here, except there is a. There is kind of maybe an element of hope here, or at least a wink of hope. That's the way this book is going to end. So we're at the very end of chapter 25, and the last four verses tell us that in the 37th year of the exile of Jehoiachin, king of Babylon, in the 12th month, 27th day of the month, the next king, or a king, a guy by the name of Evil-Merodach, so not this isn't Nebuchadnezzar, this is another king of Babylon, he freed Jehoiachin, king of Judah, from prison. It's kind of a Joseph kind of moment, right? So Joseph was in prison. He was brought up from prison. And that's what happens to this guy. So Jehoiachin is taken out of prison. It says he spoke kindly to him. He gave him a seat at his table. In fact, he gave him a seat above the seats of the other kings who were there. So there were other kings that were, you know, been captured or overpowered by the Babylonians, and they were there. But Jehoiachin, hey, he gets the highest seat. He gets a change of clothes. He takes off his prison clothes, gets some new clothes. And every day of his life, he dined at the king's table. And for his allowance, a regular allowance was given him by the king according to his daily needs as long as he lived. Period. End of 2 Kings. So it seems that what the author is intending here is to hold out a little bit of hope that maybe there is hope for a son of David. Maybe something will happen down the road with this. Now, that's where he leaves the story. It's up to us to know what's going to happen after that. But what does happen after that is that you never have a son of David sitting on the throne in Jerusalem with the Davidic kingdom restored. You're still waiting for the son of David to come, you know, over about six centuries later when Christ himself is born. But that's kind of the way the book, it kind of leaves us hanging, wondering, okay, exile, the king of the last king of Israel or one of the last king of Israel is there. He's dining at the king's table. What's going to happen? What's going to happen next?
Yeah. And that is it, man. We have made it through 2 Kings. I will tell you guys just up front that we're not going to go into 1 and 2 Chronicles. And we've done everything in the order that your Bible has it thus far. We've decided not to do that. We will do it eventually, but we have decided that this would just be 1 and 2 Kings all over again, which is what 1 and 2 Chronicles is. And so we're going to take a break from that, and we're going to go into the book of Ezra. But we will get to 1 and 2 Chronicles eventually.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we decided jumping right from Kings to Chronicles would be like jumping right from Matthew to Mark or...
Yeah. And if you listen to... If you're a listener to 30 Minutes in the New Testament, we don't do that. We did Matthew and then we went on to something else. We've covered all the Gospels, but we did not do them back to back to back. We didn't do all four of them in a row. And so yeah, very similar situation. So 2 Kings, that was... depressing, but yeah. But it shows you the need for Jesus, to be sure. And so we will come back next week and start looking at Ezra. I'll see you then, Chad.
All right, see you then.